Mother of grace, we pause at this moment and think of those whose lives have been put on hold, those who've had their lives interrupted, their dreams deferred, and we wonder how they can go on. We pray for them, and we wonder if we too would have the same spirit, that same drive, if it was us. Thou, teach our leaders to lead not from a place of reaction, or from arrogance, or from fear or hatred. Help our leaders to lead from a place of hope, a place of compassion, the only source of true strength in a world torn by factionalism and strife, where war has beget war and refugees have become homeless. May we find new ways to house the homeless, to feed the hungry, to welcome the stranger, and not fall prey to a gospel of indifference and distance. We hold in our hearts the Syrian refugees. May we not be swayed by false or confusing reports that make all of them, them, and not like all of us. May we be in solidarity with these peaceful neighbors who need us. We keep also in our prayers those who are struggling with cancer, as well as those who have babies on the way and those whose babies are turning 18. In our global world, may we learn to be a global neighbor, rooted in a hope of a world where peace is at its center. Amen. Let us be in silence for a few moments.
The reading this morning was written by Naomi Shihab Nye, and I will read it in her words. Wandering around the Albuquerque Airport terminal, after learning my flight had been delayed for 4 hours, I heard an announcement. If anyone in the vicinity of Gate A4 understands any Arabic, please come to the gate immediately. Well, one pauses these days. Gate A4 was my own gate. I went there. An older woman in full traditional Palestinian embroidered dress, just like my grandma wore, was crumpled to the floor, wailing loudly. Help, said the flight service person. Talk to her. What is her problem? We told her the flight was going to be late, and she did this. I stooped to put my arm around the woman and spoke to her haltingly. Shudawa, shubidluk, abiti, stanti shwai, min fadlik, subitsiwi. The minute she heard any words she knew, however poorly used, she stopped crying. She thought the flight had been canceled entirely, but she needed to be in El Paso for major medical treatment the very next day. I said to her, no, we're fine. You'll get there just later. Who's picking you up? Let's call him. We called her son, and I spoke with him in English. I told him I would stay with his mother till we got on the plane and would ride next to her. This was Southwest Airlines. She talked to him. Then we called her other sons just for the fun of it. Then we called my dad, and he and she spoke for a while in Arabic and found out, of course, that they had 10 shared friends. Then I thought, just for the heck of it, why not call some Palestinian poets I know and let them chat with her? Well, this all took up about 2 hours. She was laughing a lot by then, telling about her life, patting my knee, answering questions. She had pulled a stack of homemade mamoud cookies, little powdered sugar crumbly mounds stuffed with dates and nuts, out of her bag and was offering them to all the women at the gate. To my amazement, not a single woman declined one. It was like a sacrament. The traveler from Argentina, the mom from California, the lovely woman from Laredo, we were all covered with the same powdered sugar and smiling. And there is no better cookie. And then the airline broke out free beverages from huge coolers, and two little girls from our flight ran around serving us all apple juice, and they too were covered with powdered sugar. And I noticed my new best friend, by now we were holding hands, had a potted plant sticking out, some medicinal thing, with green furry leaves. Such an old country tradition. Always carry a plant. Always stay rooted to somewhere. And I look around the gate of late and weary ones, and I thought, this is the world I want to live in. The shared world. Not a single person in that gate, once the crying and confusion had stopped, seemed apprehensive about any other person. They took the cookies. I wanted to hug them all, those other women too. This can still happen anywhere. Not everything is lost.
Imagine there are some prisoners who have been chained in a cave as long as they can remember. And they're chained in such a way so that all they can see is the wall, the back wall of the cave. And every morning when the sun comes up and shines into the cave, shadows pass by. The shadows of people and animals and objects go by. And the prisoners themselves have gotten so good they're able to identify what those shadows are. They'll say, oh, it looks like an animal's coming. Oh, it's the dog. Here comes the dog. And then, oh, there's the older woman. There she is. There's the old lady. Oh, and look, and there's somebody, they're carrying a chair. Or maybe it's a footstool. It's a footstool. That's what it is. And then one day, one of these prisoners is released. And he climbs up to the mouth of a cave, and his eyes hurt so much because he's never seen the strong, clear light of the sun. But after a while, his eyes come into focus, and he looks around, and it's a whole new world out there. There's sounds and there's smells and the sights where before everything he had seen was just in two dimensions, shadows projected on the wall. Now everything is 3D. And he sees the dog, and it comes up and he pets it and it's furry, and he sees the old lady and he says hello, and she says hello back, and he sees people carrying things, and he sees trees, and he sees the shadow of trees. And he realizes that the shadows that he was seeing were just shadows. They weren't the real thing. They had thought they were the real thing in the caves, but now he's seeing the real thing. And after a couple of days of having his mind blown, he thinks once again of his compatriots back in that cave. So he goes back there and he tries to explain to them what he's seen and how the shadows that they see are just shadows. They're not the real things. And at first, his comrades think he's crazy. But then they get kind of annoyed because he's saying that their experience is not real, that's not the real world, that he knows the real world. And they get upset with him. In fact, one gets violent and knocks him down. This, of course, is Plato's allegory of the cave. A story that Plato told for two reasons. First, to say that it's difficult to be a philosopher trying to educate the public. The second was to point out his idea about ideal forms. I have to admit that when I first started putting this sermon together in my mind, I thought the first point will just be a stepping stone onto the second one. I won't talk a lot about it, but events this past week have caused me or made me realize that I need to talk a bit more about that first point, Plato's point about how difficult it is to be a philosopher, how difficult it is to say to people that two-dimensional reality that they are used to is not the real thing. Plato got into trouble. He didn't like the Athens government. They didn't like him. In fact, it was, of course, the Athenian government that had sentenced his mentor and teacher Socrates to death for being a disruptor of social order. And I have to admit that Plato sounded a little full of himself, you know, saying that most people are comfortable in their ignorance. It's tough being a philosopher. But it's true. We find so many people who are comfortable, I don't say in their ignorance, but comfortable with one worldview, which could be fine if your worldview doesn't interact with anyone else's worldview, but that's not the world we live in. It hasn't ever been, but it's certainly not true today. A friend of mine, we're on a chat list with a bunch of other folks, and we realize that a small number of older white men tended to sort of dominate this chat group, and you know, try as folks might to talk about other things, these folks sort of worked really hard to sort of bend the will back to being about them and their worldview. Even trying to make people feel bad that they weren't talking about them enough. And my friend, my very wise friend, said, "You know, before Copernicus, I know. Let me just say right now that I know some of you are thinking to yourselves, 'All right, we've already heard about Plato, and now we're hearing about Copernicus. You will leave with at least an associate's degree.' Okay, that's when I say that. That before Copernicus, people thought that the Earth was the center of the universe." And that the sun and moon and the planets and the stars and everything centered on the Earth. And then Copernicus came along and said, "Nope, actually, the Earth goes around the sun." And then a few decades later, Bruno said, "Actually, not only do we go around the sun, but that's just in our solar system. And there are many solar systems in this one galaxy that we're part of, and there are many galaxies in a universe that is endless, and there is no center to the universe at all." For those folks who lived before Copernicus, who knew the Earth was the center of the universe, it must have been really frustrating to interact with others who related to the actual infinite universe in which there was no center. These days, pre-Copernican men roam the earth, seeing their perspective as objective, their priorities as normal, and their needs as primary. It feels good to inhabit the center of the universe. Almost all institutions and policies and even dictionaries uphold their guiding fiction. In a generous moment in this chat group, a pre-Capernaum man will entertain perspectives of an African-American woman or an Arab-speaking young child, but only if it orbits, ascends, and affirms the centrality of the truth that he is the center of the universe. Here's something you may not know. The world's fastest-growing cities are Fuzhou, Ankara, Xiamen, Hangzhou, Kunming, Dubai, Bursa, and Istanbul. And what all these nodes of vitality have in common is that none is driven by a pre-Capernaum white man's perspective. None is the fruit of the Enlightenment or even a reaction to it. So the pre-Capernaum white man who insists his perspective is the objective truth is not only inaccurate, it's also increasingly absurd. And what often happens is that these folks, they realize that not only is their point, their way of seeing the world changing, is that their power is moving away. Their power is moving away from them. And it's not even being replaced by somebody who's like them. It's being moved to a place that has no center. And so they speak louder, and they there's more bluster, and they're more blunt. And they try to ensnare folks to come back. No, talk about me. They want us to believe that the shadows on the wall are real. They want us to believe that the center of the universe is them. They want us to believe that there are 1.5 million people at the inauguration. Alternative facts. Plato's second point in talking about the cave is to point to his idea about ideal forms. Like the shadows on the walls, things in the physical world are just flawed reflections of an ideal form. He said that there is an ideal form of everything out there. Say, like these footstools. There are all these footstools. Look, there's like this little footstool. There's the tobacco box footstool. There's the one that looks like a Christmas present back there, right? And all of us are able to look at them and say, footstool. There's enough footstoolishness in them for us to identify them. And Plato said, there must be an ultimate footstool someplace. An ultimate footstool that resides, that all these other footstools look like. For theologians like this idea. They're like, because he not only talked about like that there were like tangible things that you could hold and say there's an ultimate example of footstools. He said even intangible things like love, right? There is the ultimate form of love. In Greek, there's three or four different words for love. There's love is brotherly love, and then there's sort of like love of nation, and then there's erotic love, and then there's agape, the love of God and God's love for us, the purest, most ultimate form of love. So even things that aren't tangible have this ultimate form. And theologians, of course, love this. Theologians came along, they were like, yes, and all of those ultimate images are stored in the mind of God, and it's this whole great thing. I don't know if I believe that. I actually think that each one of us have in the back of our minds like a whole library. I don't know if it was downloaded when we were born, or like if the first footstool you ever saw was at your grandmother's house or was here or was a cartoon. Like that footstool image is in the back of your head. And then when you see something that looks footstoolish, you kind of go, it's a footstool. Maybe it's a milking stool, but that's probably a footstool. And we're able to look at them and sort of say, oh, right, there's something footstoolish about that. And what that proves is that we all have a bit of the truth. We all have a bit of the truth. Not just about footstools, but about everything else. We all have a bit of the truth. But we don't have the ultimate truth, right? We don't know what that ultimate footstool looks like. But we all have a bit of the truth. And that should make us hungry and humble. Hungry because we realize, oh, there's more out there for us to learn about. There's more out there for us to gain knowledge of. But also humble because, what do they say? The more you don't know, right? We will never know everything. So that should keep us humble. It's one of the things about being a Unitarian Universalist. Ever since the time of the Transcendentalists, who sort of said, there are other faiths out there. And they've been going okay without us. Maybe they have some wisdom that would be important for us. And so really for the first time in the West, you have these people who are studying Buddhism and studying Hinduism and sort of saying, are these similar to Christianity? Are there things that they're weighing them? They're sort of saying, are they better than us, worse than us? Are there things we can reject, things we can embrace? This idea that we all have some of the truth, but no, none of us have none of the truth, is what allows us as Unitarian Universalists to stick together. Right? That here we are in this church, and there are people here who perhaps say they're Buddhists, or they're part of a contemporary pagan group, or they're Christians, and we're able to all stay here because we all realize that we all have a part of the truth, but not all of it. I had a professor in college who in seminary, and it was a class on Buddhism, and he had us read all these really difficult and strange books about Buddhism. The first book was like the Diamond Sutra from the Pure Land tradition. It was impregnable. It was so hard to read. It was like a diamond. It was just so hard to figure out. And then the next book he had us read was a comic book. And then we read a book by a Tibetan nun, and then a book by a monk who, like, stole motorcycles. And at one point we said to the professor, like, what's the deal? Why are you having us read all of these different books? And he said, each one of these books is a little window. He said, you know, if I taught Buddhism the way we teach Christianity, you would learn about the life of Buddha, and then a few hundred years after his death. And then you'd go out of here, and you'd meet a Buddhist, and they'd tell you about what they believe and what they do, and you'd say to yourself, that's not Buddhism. And then you'd tell them what it is that what you just learned, and they'd say, well, that's not Buddhism either. He said, each one of these things, it's like a window on a prism, that you're able to have a view into it. And each window you're able to look further and further into, you're able to get a clearer idea of what's in the center of that belief system. And what's great is that when I think about this world where there is no center of the universe any longer, where issues of diversity are become heated, that our faith can really be a model, can really be an example to the rest of the world of how to do this. When I think of that reading, that wonderful, Marvin read it so well this morning, I sometimes think that this is what the role of our faith can be. That we can be those compassionate people who offer a strong arm, who offer kind words, and can bring that person whose life has sort of fallen together, whose understanding of the universe has collapsed on itself. That we might be able to be the ones to offer those warm words, to bring them back into the circle of their family and friends, and maybe even interact with our circle of friends. And then there's smiling, and then there's cookies. This is the world I want to live in, the shared world. And I bet it's the world that you want to live in as well. This can happen anywhere. Not everything is lost. And here we are, so this is it. Our worship is over. Our service begins. Amen.